6 minutes after 9 o'clock. And John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 9 o'clock on Mondays is devoted to all things political here on the Kathleen Dunn program. And we'll certainly be doing that today. We'll talk about lots of political news and issues and get your take on it as well. My guest this morning is Rodolfo Espino, assistant professor at the Department of Political Science at Arizona State University. Well, Professor, good morning, and thanks for joining me here today.
Good morning.
Big week of political news. Let's talk about what some people might say was the big political story of the week. Actually, there were a pair of them, but one of them, we'll take them in chronological order, one of them was the compromise tax bill that President Obama worked out with Republican lawmakers, much to the chagrin of some in his own party, including the outgoing Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. Was this a win for President Obama or for the Republicans?
I think it's probably a win for both. Obama, in his speech discussing this bill, he said that he admitted that there are some things in there that he didn't like, but that this is part of politics. Politics involves compromise, so he had to accept some of the things he didn't like to get the things that he did like. And one of those big things that I think he can claim as a victory is the large extension of unemployment benefits. You know, we still have high unemployment rates. There's a lot of working families out there suffering, and that was one of the progressive Democrats' key points that they wanted to get out of this was extension of unemployment. Why some of the progressive liberal Democrats are so upset, however, is extending the Bush tax cuts for the upper income tax bracket. That is something that they thought was problematic, especially since we have growing deficits over the last decade. We hear more about deficit spending. Deficit spending has become a Republican talking point, yet Republicans were not willing to let those tax cuts for that tax bracket expire. They want tax cuts for all, and that's something that really ruffled the feathers of the progressive Democratic caucus.
Well, you mentioned the deficit and the total package in the combined unemployment extension and the various tax breaks in this compromise bill, more than $800 billion. And where are the deficit hawks? I mean, they didn't Congress passed this. They still haven't. The Senate still hasn't passed a budget. And nobody has any idea how this is going to be paid for.
No. Well, not anytime soon. And so we're doing, well, Congress is doing what they've been doing, you know, for the last decade. It's just, you know, passing it, you know, pushing it down the road for the next Congress to deal with. And unfortunately, just, you know, it's a tough thing to deal with. You know, you look at the economic indicators. There's some trailing economic indicators, namely unemployment, that you got to deal with. And you know, Democrats have a different vision of how you stimulate the economy, and that has to do more with getting money into the hands of people right away, such as a payroll tax break and also unemployment benefits. Republicans take a different vision, and that's sort of the trickle-down philosophies, that if you give money to the top bracket, that will eventually stimulate the economy by the creation of jobs. And you're just at a sticking point between those two philosophies, and this is the best that Obama could do.
Let's talk about that payroll tax change that will come into effect on the 1st of January. I guess I've been a little confused by that, which probably should surprise no one, but I've been a little confused by that. I mean, that if they reduce the payroll tax, then that reduces the amount of money that's available to pay Social Security benefits, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And so it's just going to add more to our deficit. But this is where some observers point out this is a huge win for Obama, in the sense that you're getting money back into working class families sooner than later. And that is, according to their view, one of the best ways to stimulate the economy. And dealing with the deficit is something that has to be dealt with, but some of these observers will point out, just saying now is not the right time to deal with it. We'll deal with it when we're out of this, completely out of this recession.
Well, and I've been listening to a lot of economists. It's hard to turn on a newscast without hearing from one of them. But a lot of the discussion has been around the fact that American businesses right now are sitting on $2 trillion, that's trillion with a T, dollars of cash, and they're not hiring. and they're still making money. So what's going to happen if these companies say, you know what, we don't need to hire anybody. We can still be profitable and not spend all this money or risk any of it. What happens to the recovery then, I wonder, and who's going to pay a political price for that?
Well, that's a good question. This involves a lot of those economic forecasts that, frankly, I'm not in the business of engaging in. But what we, again, it goes to different philosophies. Republicans generally take the view that if you get money into the hands of, you know, upper tax brackets or back to businesses as soon as possible, that will create jobs. But most people agree that that just doesn't happen overnight, right? And it will take some time for those businesses who are sitting on that cash to feel comfortable enough to start opening, you know, the hiring pool. Right now, there's still a lot of uncertainty, and I think a lot of that uncertainty, from what I understand, surrounded the tax, the tax situation. Were these the Bush tax rates going to be extended? It turns out they're going to just be around for a couple more years at least. What were they going to do with payroll? And people anticipate now that uncertainty about the tax situation is resolved, we can anticipate that there might be more hiring in the next few quarters, which would stimulate the economy, not right away. It would take about a year or two still, but that might benefit Barack Obama tremendously heading into the 2012 election. You know, most voters, there's research by Larry Bartels, a political scientist at Princeton University, that points out that presidents derive great benefits from voters when there is tremendous spending and benefits and tax cuts and a good economy in the last year that they are in office, not the overall run that, the whole 4 years. That he terms voters as myopic. They have tunnel vision. They only look at the last year. And if these things go as planned, as Obama and his advisors anticipate they will, it looks like we hit the 2012 general election cycle with a growing economy. And, you know, hopefully we get that on those unemployment numbers down by then.
All right, well, I'm going to give the phone numbers here. I should have done that off the top of the program because it's a different number than the one people are used to using for the Kathleen Dunn program. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. You can also get in touch with us via email. The address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. And you can go to the Kathleen Dunn Facebook fan page and leave a message for us there, and we'll put it to the listening public via my voice. Where it's all things political for this Monday morning. We're talking about the political news of the last week and the last few days. Lots to talk about with my guest, Professor Rodolfo Espino, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Arizona State University. Professor, let's talk a little bit about the other big vote in Congress over the weekend, and that was the vote in the Senate to end the 17-year-old military policy of don't ask, don't tell. How surprised were you? Maybe you weren't. You probably know a lot more about some of this stuff than I do, but I was surprised that there was enough GOP support in the Senate to get this bill passed during the lame duck session. Is this a recognition that the culture in the United States has changed?
To a certain extent, I wouldn't say that it's completely over for the gay lesbian community in terms of some of the battles that they still have to fight for equal protection under the law. Namely, I think the next hurdle that they have to cross is what about a marriage? You see that being dealt with at the state level. What is the Congress going to do? The last thing that they did on this was the Defense of Marriage Act, and I think that's the next thing that they would like to, that the community would like to try to repeal. But I don't want to take away from the victory that can be seen in the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. It's certainly a tremendous accomplishment. It's been a long time coming for gay and lesbian members of the military, who had to keep silent about their own sexual orientation. And to see the Senate move in its glacial pace may be frustrating for some, but it's how it works, and it eventually has happened. It's To your other question, though, is this a sign that our culture has completely changed? I wouldn't say no. And again, I go to the, you know, the marriage issue. There are certain things that our country is not ready for that other countries have already moved ahead on. But and was I surprised about this? I would say not entirely. There's some signals, especially from the military brass, that this was something that had to be done. In fact, you had Secretary of Defense Bob Gates coming out quite forcefully after they conducted their own internal study, saying that there was not going to be any harm done by repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So to finally get that signal from the Pentagon itself, I think gave a lot of cover, if you will, for GOP senators to vote for its repeal.
Yeah, well, I hate to place too much weight on one vote, but does this suggest that bipartisan work is actually possible in the Senate? Because it sure hasn't seemed like it is for the past couple of years.
That's a good question. My answer to that is most likely not. I would not put a whole lot of weight onto this single vote that we have entered a new era of bipartisanship. But it does signal that there might be some new alliances forming, with certain senators. We might see, we've always heard of Olympia Snowe and Susan Collins as being these brokers, these pivot points. But I think you got some new Republican names in the mix. You know, keep in mind that Democrats are still majority control of the Senate, although that doesn't mean a whole lot until you have that magic 60 vote to shut down filibusters. But I think you want to be looking at names coming out, namely Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and Scott Brown of Massachusetts. These are names that you might see in the future of the Senate in terms of being these deal brokers that are going to be these pivot points that will, you know, be that bridge between Republicans and Democrats. And I think that their votes were critical in the passage of Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Well, I think Senator Brown has been a real surprise in the Senate. He certainly doesn't seem like an ideologue, and
yeah.
He has shown that he's willing to say no and not drink the Kool-Aid and go along with the party leadership.
Absolutely. If you recall the famous quote from Tip O'Neill that all politics local, Tip O'Neill, a former representative from Massachusetts, Scott Brown now from Massachusetts, he's an embodiment of how all politics is local. Massachusetts tends to be a liberal state. I think that for some individuals within the Tea Party movement, that Scott Brown perhaps has been a disappointment for them, that there was a lot of hopes pinned on him, that he was going to, he was going to change the makeup of Republicans in the Senate, make them more principled, but he certainly has not done that. But, that shouldn't be surprising. His electoral base is not the Tea Party nation as a whole. It is the state of Massachusetts.
Well, I know the Tea Party will come up during this morning's discussion. There were some things that happened over the weekend, some stuff that was said I want to talk to you about. But I also, we need to take a break when we come back. I also want to talk about an issue that's close to where you are in Arizona, a couple of stories that came out of there, and your governor is in the news again. And I want to talk about those with you and get your take on that as somebody who's at in Tempe and right in the heart of things, find out what you think about what's going on down there. And we have some callers as well. You could be one of them at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org. Talk at WPR.org is the email address. You can also find the Kathleen Dunn Program on Facebook and leave a comment there as well. It's All Things Political for this Monday, the 20th of December, 2010. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 21 minutes after 9 o'clock, you're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. Here's what's coming up a little bit later on the Ideas Network. Holidays and tough economic times don't sound like a good fit, but at issue with Ben Marins after 5, Ben's guest says that this is a good year to embrace the holiday spirit. That's after 5 o'clock today on At Issue with my good friend Ben Marins. This hour, it's All Things Political. We're talking about the political news of the week and of the day and of the weekend, and and up to the minute. My guest is Rodolfo Espino, assistant professor in the Department of Political Science at Arizona State University. And professor, I said I teased before the break that when we came back, I wanted to talk about a couple of things that were going on in Arizona and that made the national news. And I wanted to get your take on it. Of course, the big story out of Arizona for the last year has been about immigration. Last week, the Arizona Senate is now considering a new law that would deny the principle of birthright citizenship. That is, if you're born in this country, you are a citizen regardless of whether your parents are here legally or not. It would appear to me, and I took some constitutional law classes as part of my political science studies some years ago, but it would appear to me that a law like that would violate the 14th Amendment of the Constitution of the United States. What's your take on that law?
I don't claim to be a legal scholar, but my sentiment is the same as yours, that this would be a dramatic change to how we understand the 14th Amendment in contemporary United States. There are some proponents of this law, however, that point out that some decisions from the 19th century don't necessarily guarantee birthright citizenship. Looking at some court decisions from then saying that the court does not guarantee birthright citizenship according to the 14th Amendment. And the proponents of the law within here in Arizona, the sponsor of it, namely Russell Pierce, have suggested that they're not so concerned about that either, that they see this more as an opportunity to create litmus tests for the Supreme Court. And so there, it seems to me that some of these Arizona politicians that we have in the state legislature, such as Russell Pierce, are more interested not so much in solving our budget crisis, but more interested in creating court cases for the Supreme Court to rule on with respect to immigration.
Well, and speaking of budget, your governor was in the news. You've got some Medicaid cuts coming, and some people are saying that these are going to be pretty serious. My understanding is that some people who are waiting for life-saving organ transplants won't be able to get them.
Yeah, that's correct. There's been some dramatic cuts to a lot of our state programs. K through 12 has been hit hard. So has our ACCESS program. That's it stands for the Arizona Healthcare Cost Containment System, that for individuals that meet eligibility requirements, the state will kick in certain amounts of funds to help them for certain medical procedures. And there's some people on a waiting list for life-saving organ transplants. There are some stories of individuals who are going to be denied that, or an individual who I believe has already died from being denied health care coverage through the ACCESS program here in Arizona. It's certainly a tragic thing, but then politics gets involved. People point fingers. Democrats, of course, are pointing fingers at Brewer. Brewer's saying, pointing fingers at the federal government, saying that this is part of, she's termed it as part of Obamacare, which, frankly, I find a little odd because a lot of the requirements for Obamacare have not kicked in and won't kick in for a while. This has the cuts to ACCESS have more to do with the budget crisis that Arizona has been going through over the last 2 years, and not so much with what the federal government has done with respect to passing health care coverage.
Well, as I was reading some of the stories about this, I was struck by, most states are in the same position as Arizona. In their last budget go-round, they had help from the stimulus bill. Even those governors who didn't like the stimulus bill, and Governor Brewer in your state was one, the legislature took the money and they were able to patch their budget hole with it. Now they've got an even bigger budget problem and no more stimulus money coming down the pipeline. And Arizona, like a lot of other states in the United States, is facing some very, very serious budget issues. And no one wants to raise taxes in a down economy or any other time for that matter. So you've got this problem where you have money that you have to spend. And I think in your case, the medical assistance portion of the budget is what, like one third of the entire state budget, or is it bigger? It's a pretty big number. A lot of states in the same boat. It's just going to be a really, really tough time to be in the state legislature. You're going to have to make somebody really, really unhappy in a hurry.
Yeah, and Arizona, unfortunately, may be a harbinger of things to come in other states that are facing similar budget crises, as you've indicated. And also, as you indicated, the votes aren't there to get another stimulus package passed that would help states. Brewer and the Republican legislature here in Arizona were happy enough to take the money at the time, although they were critical of it. They used it to get us through a couple years. Now we're without that money, and some tough decisions are going to be have to be made. And going back to some of the leadership that we have in the legislature, I frankly think that they are more concerned about some other issues than dealing with some of these tough decisions about how we fix the budget.
They certainly wouldn't be unique in that respect. Look at the United States Senate. They have been able to act on a lot of stuff, but they still haven't passed a federal budget.
Well, you're correct, but the difference between a lot of states and the federal government is that we here in Arizona can't engage in deficit spending. So we can't just kick it down the road. We have to make the cuts immediately, and some of those cuts are going to be quite painful, and we're seeing that already.
Well, let's change gears here. We've talked a little bit about immigration, we've talked about state budgets. I'd like to go to an international issue, and that is the before we leave the immigration area. I want to just bring up the Democrats would still. It doesn't look like this is going to happen, but last week, the Democrats were talking still about trying to get what's called the DREAM Act passed in this lame duck session, and a law that would – it's an immigration bill that would provide a pathway to citizenship under certain conditions for immigrants who were brought to the U.S. illegally as children. So your parents bring you in illegally. This bill would provide a pathway to citizenship for those children. What do you think are the chances that that will ever become law?
With the current Congress, the lame duck Congress, none at all. In fact, over the weekend there was a vote, and there were not enough votes in the Senate to agree to bring it to the floor for a vote. There were some conservative blue dog Democrats that voted against it. There were some liberal Republicans that actually voted to bring it to the floor, but again, you did not hit that magic 60 vote number that you need in the Senate to agree to bring something to debate to the floor, and so it looks like it's done for the current Congress. I don't anticipate that the next Congress is going to be willing to take it up. For folks that have been fighting this battle, basically since 1986, it's a huge letdown. They're trying to figure out how to regroup and bring pressure back on Congress to shoot this down. So, on the one hand, you can look at, there's victory for some of the progressive community with repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, but there's certain, despondency within that community for failure to pass the DREAM Act, which, I think is unfortunate. And I say that because, you look at public opinion polling, and when you ask voters, the average voter out there, what they think about some of the provisions, hey, this person came here as a child, they've been raised here all their life, they're not a legal U.S. citizen, but if you let them go to college, do some service, or serve in the military, most Americans are supportive of those provisions of the DREAM Act. The DREAM Act, it's important to point out, is just a tiny component of comprehensive immigration reform. Most people on both sides of the political aisle will recognize that our immigration system is broken and needs repair. The Immigrant Rights Advocates will point out that DREAM Act is just a tiny sliver that gets us on the road towards comprehensive immigration reform. But without getting the DREAM Act passed, it just does not look like the rest of the package of comprehensive immigration reform is going to happen in the immediate future.
Well, let's change gears here. First of all, put the call out for more callers. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Call in and let us know what you thought. What political news story would you like to hear us talk about? What would you like to talk about? 800-642-1234. Let's take a call. We'll start with Jim in Milwaukee.
Yes, hi. What I'd like to talk about is a couple of under-the-radar stories that illustrate for me that there's not much Christianity in Christmas. And the first one is that there is a report that the collar counties of the Chicago, of the city of Chicago, between 2000 and 2010 had a 9 to 10% drop in median income. And this suggests to me that corporate America has started assaulting the middle class and that it constitutes a threat to the middle class that we should rightfully fear. And I don't think it's very Christian. And the other thing that I think it isn't very Christian is involves comments by Senator Jim DeMint on the START treaty, where he said that it was sacrilegious to consider this during the religious holidays. Well, the Beatitudes say, blessed are the peacemakers, and I think in terms of peacemaking, the START treaty is very important and very appropriate for the Christmas holidays.
Professor?
Jim, I believe from Milwaukee, has a couple of interesting things. I'll start first with Jim DeMint's comments related to the START treaty. As we know, the START treaty has to be, revisited and passed again by the Senate. Republicans in the Senate have been holding it hostage. This is something that actually goes back to Ronald Reagan. Republicans back then were for it, and it's interesting to see that Republicans today are not supportive of the START treaty, and particularly Senator Jim DeMint. I owe it a lot to political posturing, however. Not so much, that it's a Christian versus non-Christian thing. Of course, Jim DeMint framed it that way, saying it's how dare you make us work during the Christian holiday season. But it more has to do with Jim DeMint and other Republicans in the Senate just saying no to anything that the President Obama would like. Median income, this is a tough holiday season, and the numbers that he pointed out in the Chicago area, I think, are reflective in other metropolitan areas across the country. There are a lot of families that are facing a tough time, and hopefully this tax cut package that the Democrats in the White House and Republicans in the Senate cobble together is enough to help some of these families that are facing some tough times during this holiday season.
Well, the START treaty, I mean, this you've got some discussion over about U.S. security and so forth. But this was signed back in April. It's not like this was sprung on the Senate at the last possible moment. It just hasn't come up until now. But is this more about Republicans continuing their campaign to never, unless they absolutely have to, give President Obama any kind of political victory?
I would say yes. Republicans in the House and in the Senate much more disciplined, I'd say, Democrats on all things being equal, in terms of being able to hold the party line and say no or say yes, to whatever it is that they're for. And right now they've been engaged in the politics of just stymieing everything that President Obama wants, even if it's something that they, as a party, were in favor of. You sense some of the hypocrisy that comes out in some of this congressional politics. This START treaty was something that Republican leadership, one of their most revered presidents, their icon, Ronald Reagan, was responsible for. And to see Republicans today against it, well, it's really because they're against President Obama and his policies, and just trying to stymie his efforts to, win political points. But at the end of the day, I think the American public is, for the most part, is shrewd enough to see through some of this. You look at approval ratings of Congress versus the White House. President Obama is enjoying higher approval ratings than Congress is right now. And I think that the more that Congress engages in some of this politicking, the public is going to get more and more fed up with them. And it's just going to, give more credence to and wins in the sale of President Obama and getting things that he wants done. And it might backfire on Republicans in the end.
Let's go back to the phones, and we'll talk to we'll go to Eagle River next. We'll talk with Jack, find out what's on Jack's mind this morning.
Yes, good morning.
Jack, good morning.
Good
Thanks
morning.
For joining us.
Thank you. I wish I could agree with what your guest just said, but I don't think the voters are shrewd enough to make the connections that should be made. For example, on so many issues, they agree with the Democrats, but where were they in the last election? They didn't hold anybody accountable that should have been held, in my view, should have been held accountable. So I just don't agree that the voters do figure it out. I hope he's right, but I just don't think they will.
Professor?
Yeah, Jack at Eagle River, thanks for that call. Yeah, I guess what I was anticipating was more just come the 2012 election, that if Congress were, especially Republicans in the Senate, are going to engage in this politicking where they're going to say no to everything, even no to things that the majority of Americans are for, eventually the American voters will get fed up with it. I mean, I agree with you. There's a lot of things that they just don't see. Part of it is they just don't. The average voter out there just does not pay attention to politics. They're busy working. They don't study it as much as some of us do. But if we look back during the fights that the Clinton White House had with Republican Congress at the time in 95 to 96, there was a government shutdown. Republicans were saying no, no, no to what the Clinton White House was wanting, and it led to a government shutdown. And who paid the price? Well, not Bill Clinton in the White House. It was Republicans that had it backfire on them. And so I think that's what my comment was more directed at, is just the voters being frustrated with the overall politicking and, you know, stalling of important legislation that it seems like Republicans in the past, in 95, 96, and heading into the present right now are engaging in. But I do agree with the caller, Jack, at Eagle River, that, you know, there are some things that the voters, again, look at Larry Bartels' research on how voters are myopic in their voting decisions.
Well, I mean, there were a lot of people who voted in this last election who believed that the stimulus that President Obama had through the stimulus bill raised their taxes, when in fact the stimulus bill contained a tax cut.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of misinformation out there, and I think, you know, part of it, there's certainly some media effects, and there's certain campaign effects, right? So I don't want to put all the blame upon the voter themselves. I'd like to attribute some of that blame to the media and to political candidates out there.
All right, let's see. Let's take a call. Let's go to Fish Creek next, and we'll talk with Steve. Steve, good morning.
I'm glad to hear you place a little bit of blame on the media, because I'm calling because of the fact that there's been a blackout on this event that occurred on the same day that Obama was releasing his upbeat report on Afghanistan. 131 war veterans were arrested in Washington, D.C., chaining themselves to the White House fence, basically wanting to stop the war, and there's been no coverage in the news about this. Daniel Ellsberg, 80 years old, celebrated his birthday, getting arrested for the 80th time in his life. Ray McGovern used to be a presidential advisor. Chris Hedges, Colleen Rowley, FBI whistleblower. All these people were arrested in Washington, along with war veterans protesting, and it got zero coverage in the U.S. press. You've got to go to Australia to read about it, or to any of the left-wing blogs like Huffington Post and places like that. So, and I'm not hearing you guys talk about it.
Well, I saw your comment come up in the comment screen, I wanted to wait and let you talk about it. But, Professor, were you aware of any of this?
Well, we've been hearing more about it, not as much as you do here in other countries, and Steve is absolutely correct. We are sort of now in a position of going alone in Afghanistan. Some of our strongest allies that have been there for us in the past, England, you know, Italy, take your pick of some of our European allies. They're starting to slowly pull out and, you know, and not want to have their troops there. And this is going to be the weight on President. There's a lot of stuff on President Obama's back, but this is one of those things that voters are going to tire. We've been in there for an entire decade. This has been one of the longest conflicts we've been in, and there really is no end in sight as far as we can see, right? The situation in there is not improving. The supposed government that is supposed to be our friend there, there's a lot of information out coming out that they are not the allies that we thought them to be. And I think if I were advising President Obama, the best thing to do would be to get our troops out of there. And there actually seems to be enough Republican support for a troop withdrawal as soon as possible to get out of the situation in Afghanistan.
Well, it's certainly been a black hole of money. I mean, if you look at what was spent on Iraq and Afghanistan over the last 10 years and apply that number to what our budget deficits are, It's a pretty interesting picture.
Yeah, it is. And I think the one thing that, and that really doesn't come up in discussions as much. You know, we hear.
Why
about,
is that? Why is that like that? It's like that's off limits.
Yeah.
We can talk about domestic spending all day long as contributing to the budget deficit, but the elephant in the room and the big expense outside of entitlement programs is defense, and yet we don't hear. We don't hear anybody really on either side of the political aisle willing to step up and say, hey, you know what? We spent $1 trillion on a war. Guess what? We're in the hole.
Yeah. You know, when we talk about discretionary versus non-discretionary spending, we usually lump. We just think of technically non-discretionary spending as Medicare and Social Security. But informally, the military and defense spending is sort of a non-discretionary spending category as well. You know, the politicians are not too eager about cutting programs for the military for fear of being charged as weak on defense. And, you know, that is a big chunk of it. When you lump defense and these entitlement programs all together, there's about two-thirds of our federal spending right there, and leaves members of Congress only with about one-third to actually fix our deficit. And that's not enough to fix our deficit spending problems right now. And if the sooner that we can get out of Afghanistan and streamline our military. In fact, Secretary Gates has been for talking about how we can streamline spending at the Pentagon, although you have congressional members of Congress that are not for it for a host of reasons, and a lot of these are parochial interests.
Well, it's jobs.
It's jobs. It's jobs. The build, you know, the defense industry has been really shrewd in how they build a plane or a ship. They don't build it in one location. They build it in many congressional districts. And this makes members of Congress scared to cut things that might affect, you know, workers in their home districts.
Well, it's how the military ends up with weapon systems they don't even want. I mean, they go to Congress and say, we don't want this, and they get it anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. I forget the details. It was in the news about a year ago with Bob Gates not wanting to have a certain kind of plane built. But yet congressional leaders put it back in the, you know, defense spending bill because they wanted it. This is the way Congress works.
Or doesn't work,
if you will. Yeah, it's a lot of, you know, candidate-centered re-election interests. And when you have the building of a ship or building of a plane spread out across many congressional districts, it's very difficult to get members of Congress to say no.
Well, at some point, somebody is going to have to, and we'll hopefully figure out how to do that. Nobody likes to see anybody lose jobs, so we need to maybe find a way to fix that at the same time. Who knows? Maybe somebody will come up with the magic fairy dust and make it happen. What we need to do right now is take a break, and suddenly we have a full bank of phones, so we'll go to callers on the other side of this break. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 9:46, you're listening to All Things Political on the Kathleen Dunn Program for this Monday, the 20th of December, 2010. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn all this week. Well, Monday through Thursday, anyway. Coming up next hour, my guests next hour were involved in bringing the Mummies of the World exhibition, now showing at the Milwaukee Public Museum. It'll be All Things Mummied next hour here on the Kathleen Dunn Program. This hour, it's All Things Political, and my guest is Rodolfo Espino, Assistant Professor of the Department of Political Science at Arizona State University. We've been having, I hope, an interesting conversation about all things political this morning. And let's have some more callers join us. We'll go to La Crosse next, go down to the Cooley region of Wisconsin, and talk to Bruce and see what's on Bruce's mind. Bruce, good morning.
Yes, good morning. I just have a quick comment. I'm so distressed with the dysfunction in our federal government that I'd like to make just a quick analogy. I see what's happening as two firemen standing outside a burning house, and they're very busily engaged chopping each other's fire hoses in half because each one thinks they have the best way to put out the fire. And while they're doing this, the house and everyone in it burns to the ground, and we're in that house. Thank you.
Wow, that, Bruce, can I quote that? That's a great analogy. Professor?
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, the fire that's burning right now is our economy, you know, close to 10% of our workforce is out of work, looking for work. And right now, you know, the analogy, you know, Democrats and Republicans seem to be not as concerned as some folks out there that are suffering, you know, with fixing the problem. And it's unfortunate that it's taken this long for them to get in some sort of compromise on a tax deal and get some quasi-stimulus package passed. This should have happened sooner than later. But Congress, as you know, most congressional observers will point out, is designed to preserve the status quo. It's very hard to get Congress to push something meaningful and substantive immediately. And part of that was intentional, part of the framers. They didn't want, you know, change to happening right away, and a lot of that's why we have a bicameral body. The Senate is more removed from the people than the House, and that's what makes it so difficult to get things passed immediately. And Congress is not the best at responding to crises, whether it be a war, whether it be a recession, and high unemployment numbers. But that's what we have to live with right now. And if there are reforms that we want to make with to Congress to make them a better crisis responder, I think we want to go it slowly, because politics is full of unintended consequences. Sometimes we make changes in the heat of the moment, and we find out years down the road that some of those changes and reforms that we make to an institution actually can backfire.
Well, the law of unintended consequences will strike. Bruce's comment reminded me of an old Klingon proverb, no one fights in a burning house.
Right.
I had to get a Klingon reference in here someplace. Thanks so much, Bruce, for that call. Let's go to Clintonville next and hear from Arlene. Arlene, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for taking my call. Good morning also to you. And I totally agree with Bruce that, you know, there are so many things that are so wrong. But one of the other things I'd like to go back to talking about that you talked about earlier are the children of the illegal immigrants who are born in this country. That last night there was one on television about 21 years old who wanted to go to college, but he didn't have a Social Security number, so he couldn't go to college. But you know something? That's telling me he's never worked. And I would just bet that he's not going to pay for his college. He wants free college. And how fair is that to our children that we have to pay for college and have worked all these years and can't afford to go to college? So that is such a big issue that is so out of hand that I'd like your input on that.
Professor?
Yeah, sir, if I understand Arlene's comment correctly, it sounds like she's a bit concerned about children of illegal immigrants receiving benefits or, let's say, even reduced tuition, such as in-state tuition, to go to college. And this, you know, this is one of those things where we want to engage, you know, what do illegal immigrants contribute to our economy? What do they take away? You know, people that on one side of the aisle will say, oh, illegal immigrants take so much in terms of health care benefits, education benefits. Individuals on the other side will say, no, they contribute so much in payroll taxes. You know, even if they have a false Social Security card, they are paying into a payroll tax, and they don't get anything out of it at the end. Most studies that I've seen will indicate that, at worst, illegal immigrants do not take anything away. It's a zero-sum game. They get as much as they put in. There are studies that actually say they put more in than they actually get out. So depending on what studies you want to look at, I would say overall, across all these studies, they say they're actually either not harmful to our economy or in some cases beneficial to our economy. And personally, I think that the more people that you get working and contributing to Social Security pool and to Medicare, supporting people over 65, you know, our Medicare costs are just soaring and soaring. And there's, you know, over the last decade, the more people, workers that we can get contributing to that, I think that helps with our deficit spending problems. There are many individuals here through no fault of their own, a decision by a parent to come here at a very early age, that find themselves in this awkward situation. They're stuck between two nations. They really don't have a home in Mexico. They can't go back there. They may not even speak the language that well, and yet they find themselves without a nation here. And many of them are very proud to be here and willing to work hard. But this is where I go back to something I mentioned earlier. Our immigration system is broken. Republicans will agree on that. Democrats need to agree on that. The problem is in the details. What sort of things are we going to work out between Republicans and Democrats? And, you know, going back to Bruce's analogy about the House burning down, you know, we have our economy burning down, and I think our immigration system is in shambles. And right now, there just is no immediate compromise in sight.
Let's take one more immigration call, and then we need to move on, and we are almost out of time. Let's go to Milwaukee. Hugh, you're up. I'll ask you to be brief.
I simply don't believe it's fair or just to allow illegal immigrants, if they get this so-called amnesty, the STREAM Act, they will have affirmative action preferences and getting promotions and jobs and getting all kinds of other benefits over people born in the United States. Why give preferences to an illegal alien over an American-born citizen? It's outrageous. Also, if they're working here and we have unemployed citizens, why not deport them to their home country and let American citizens work? And then Americans would be supporting the Social Security system and the other system. It's all part of this outrageous system we've had under liberal Republicans and, of course, most of the Democrats who want illegal aliens to invade our country. The crime, many of them are in jail. You don't talk about that and the cost of our prison systems. Many are involved in drugs and so forth. It's horrible. All we have to do is close the border. Thank God to the governor of Arizona who wants to stand up for the country when Obama and Bush refused to do so.
Okay, we're running out of time, Hugh. I think you've made your point. Professor?
Yeah, Hugh, I think speaks for a segment of the electorate out there that takes more of the closed border approach and a certain viewpoint about the negative drain that illegal immigrants have on our economy. I'll point out to some studies, though, you know, there are studies out there that show that that's not necessarily the case. That actually, most illegal immigrants actually are not engaged in criminal activity, and they actually, you know, are. You contribute to our payroll taxes and so on and so forth. I'm not sure what he was saying in terms of getting preferential treatment. The DREAM Act has nothing to do with it. In fact, you have to do some service. You're not going to get advanced over other people. And with respect to illegal immigrants taking jobs away from other Americans in the current economy, there are some jobs out there that some American citizens just don't want to do. And unless we're willing collectively to have higher food prices, you know, so the reason we can enjoy some cheap produce in our grocery stores is because of illegal immigrants. And if we're willing to say, okay, I'm willing to pay double or triple what it is, currently is, I think most Americans aren't willing to do that. And we need to recognize that there are certain benefits that they contribute, working some tough jobs for low pay. And if we can just get past this, hopefully, I think we'll be a better country for it.
Okay, I wanted to make sure we got to this call. Cindy in Paola, you'll be next, and I think this will probably be our last call. Cindy, good morning.
Good morning, thank you. Professor, I'd like to ask about the status of the Fair Elections Now Act and whether or not you think it will make any headway in this Congress.
Oh, I'm sorry, Cindy, I am not familiar with the status of that bill whatsoever, so I just feel uncomfortable speaking to it right now, if you don't mind, but if... More generally, in terms of fair elections, we have election reforms going on at the national level, also mostly at the state levels. Something I mentioned earlier is the law of unintended consequences. We always want to be careful with certain electoral changes. Here in Arizona, we created an independent redistricting commission. We've gone through one round of it. We're currently in the process of visiting it again. The idea behind it was to create more competitive elections for congressional districts and our state legislatures, and in fact, it has not done that. We have one of the most polarized legislatures in the country out there. But that's really all I can say to that. I'm not really that familiar with the status of that bill and where.
Well, for those who aren't familiar with the Fair Elections Now Act, what's it supposed to do? In briefly, and we've got about a minute left.
Oh, you know what? I don't know the details of it.
Okay, Cindy, thanks for the call, Professor. Going forward, now we're in the last week of the year. What's the over-under on Congress achieving anything meaningful between now and Christmas?
I'm surprised that they got done as much as they did in the lame duck session. You know, getting Don't Ask, Don't Tell repealed was...
Yeah, that was huge.
That was it, yeah, it was huge. Getting this tax compromise passed, you know, you had Joe Biden and Mitch McConnell working behind the scenes. I think we're probably going to see a lot of that going on with, you know, much as Dick Cheney played a lot of behind-the-scenes negotiation with the legislature during his time, I think we're going to see Joe Biden playing a much more active role than we did in his first 2 years in office. In terms of, you know, the remaining issues that Congress has to deal with, I'm not holding my breath, but
yeah, probably a good idea.
Yeah, I think the big thing to get done that they have to get accomplished is just the START treaty.
Well, we'll have to wait and see, and that'll be fodder for next week's All Things Political when Kathleen is back, I believe. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn today. My guest has been Rodolfo Espino, Assistant Professor of the Department of Political Science, Arizona State University. Professor, thanks so much. It's been a great hour. I've really enjoyed talking with you. This program was produced by Rhonda Fanning, on-air production by Erica Janik. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of WPR. Stick around. We'll be back with more after the news.